Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we've got a national treasure with us. We're with Keith Howland, lead guitar player with Chicago. He is the longest tenured guitarist with Chicago. He's been with them for 23 years. He grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, the son of an IBM worker. I like what you had said there. His oldest brother, Craig, who was 4 years his senior, no, it wasn't me, it was another Craig, was playing drums from his earliest memory, and they always had loads of pop music playing in his house. At about seven, Keith started playing guitar, and him and his brother and their neighbors immediately put together a band. In the mid-70s, his family relocated to Roanoke, Virginia, and in the late 70s to Richmond, Virginia. He played in junior high school and high school bands. Then he went to James Madison University to study computer science, where he also played in cover bands. After college, he moved out to LA to study at Guitar Institute, which is now a Musicians Institute. He spent a lot of time at the famous Baked Potato out there in LA, watching guys like Steve Lukather and Michael Landau playing. He auditioned for Olivia Newton-John in 92, gets his first major gig, and then unfortunately, Olivia got diagnosed with breast cancer, and that tour was canceled. 2 years later, he landed an audition with Patti Smyth, formerly of Scandal. She had a hit record with Don Henley at the time, and they wanted to shoot a music video for her second single called No Mistakes. She was also scheduled to perform on The Tonight Show and do a one-off live performance at Irvine Meadows Amphitheater, and Keith got those three gigs and did them with her. Finally, he was able to leave his day job when he auditioned for and got the gig with Rick Springfield. He toured all over the country, overseas in Asia. It was a great guitar gig, and Rick was a great guy to have as his boss on his what would be his first real tour. Then he got the gig with Chicago, which he's held for 23 years. He's played at pretty much every venue in this country and like a hell of a lot of venues all over the world. He's played for presidents, shared the bill with many of his childhood heroes such as Hall & Oates, Huey Lewis, the Doobie Brothers, Earth, Wind & Fire, Crosby, Stills & Nash, the Beach Boys, America, Little River Band, Peter Frampton, REO Speedwagon, and he's also performed at the band's induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Keith, I really appreciate your time, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Wow, I got to say, hearing that sort of regurgitated towards a pretty impressive thing to hear.
It is.
I was telling my wife the other day. Sometimes I sort of forget how fortunate I've been in some of these different situations. I mean, like you mentioned, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and did several shows for President Clinton. You know, the all the different bands that I got the honor. I laugh, but Hall & Oates was my opening act.
Wow. Well, that's when I was reading this, I was like, this is like pretty much every top 10 band from when, you know, we're about the same age. We're kids.
Let me clarify there. That probably isn't going to come off quite right. My opening act. They
opened for Chicago.
We did co-headlines with all of those bands. And it was just a real honor to be able to, be part of this thing that, that the Chicago's music has, the catalog of songs has allowed us to work every year for over 100 shows a year, and then to get to play with all these bands that I've loved growing up has been just amazing. The one band we have not, well, there's two bands that I still think would be a great double bill with Chicago that we haven't done yet. One being Toto,
yeah,
and one being Steely Dan.
Yeah,
I feel like both those bands would would be a great marriage for Chicago. Although, if I had to trade 8-bar solos with Steve Lukather every 6-4, I might have a panic attack.
Yeah, anybody who would not have a panic attack, man.
So
very cool. In fact, I think Toto's coming down here in like next week or something. And I want to thank Dave Amato for hooking us up, our friend Dave Amato out of Aria Speedwagon, the man, the legend.
Check him out, man. He finally did it for the entire time we were on the road, I think 2 or 3 years ago. And I'm not carrying a Les Paul on the road, right? I got Strats, I've got various different guitars, and I had my Bradshaw rig and the whole thing. And literally, like, daily, Dave is like, you know, yeah, you need to get a Les Paul.
You sound just like
Les Paul. Come on, yeah. And I'm
like, oh my God, you sound just like him.
I have a Les Paul, and they're at home. That's not what I play on this gig. And he's like, well, you need to get a Marshall too. You should get the Marshall. Get the Marshall and the Les Paul. And I'm like, Dave, I have Marshalls too. I've got several great old early 70s, you know, Marshalls and everything. And he just, so finally we're on the road this past summer and we're playing in Nashville, right? And so right during Color My World, there's no really guitar on Color My World, or at least if I decide to play or not play. So I walk off to the side of the stage and there's Dave with the Gibson rep, Philip, I forget his last name. And I pull my in-ears out and Dave goes, Dave, see, you want to get a Les Paul? Yeah, I got Philip here from Gibson. And I'm like,
oh my God.
Hey, okay, Dave. And Philip looks at me and he says, what color do you want? And I said, well, green. I'm a green guy. I love green.
Yeah, I know.
And Dave's like, oh, yeah, they want a green. It'll be a good look. And a week later, this gorgeous iguana green burst Les Paul with a Floyd on it.
Nice.
Which actually I had to argue with Dave on that because he was like, you know, hey, you want the Floyd?
Yeah, burst? Yeah, yeah.
Les Paul, Floyd, I don't know. You know, Les Paul's a stop tailpiece guitar, you know, and he said, but man, that guitar is unbelievable.
Is it his model?
No, it's not Dave's model. No, and I give him shit about that too because
the one pickup.
He got a little pissed off at me because I kept saying to Philip, like, well, what's up with the one pickup? I mean, come on, why not have the neck pickup too? So you have the, you know. So Dave was kind of, he was not happy with me about making fun of the fact that his signature model has one pickup.
Yeah. But, oh my God, I can't believe how you do his voice.
I got to say, man, it's the Access model, so it has a little bit of a thinner body, so it's lightweight, and it has a Floyd on it, and I've been playing it on pretty much about half of our show.
Oh, that's great.
No, it's great because, you know, it has the push-pull pots on the tone knobs, so you can split the humbuckers, so you can get some single coil kind of tones too. So, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, I love my Fenders and I love my Tom Andersons and my Jim Tylers and the whole thing, but I've never taken a Les Paul out with Chicago. And thanks to Dave, crazy Dave, now I have one.
Oh my God. I got to compose myself because you did his voice like spot on.
Well, I spent a lot of time with Dave.
Oh my God.
You want to hear? Here's a great Dave Amato story for you. Okay, so I had, you know, I'm carrying a Bradshaw rig on the road with me, right? And it's like a 14 rack space rack of stuff. And there was one rack space where there was no piece of gear or anything, so it was just an open rack space, so you could kind of see through it. And I showed up at the gig one night and I look at my rig and I go like, something looks different on my rig. And there was a blank black you know, rack panel, just cover the hole, because it was bothering Dave Amato that I had an open rack space in my rack. It was like actually literally like bothering him.
He's so got a little OCD, man.
This and had it put on my rig because it was driving him nuts.
Yeah. People that have a little OCD are like that, man. I know. So
he's funny.
They'll get a great, he's hilarious and he's a great guy, man. And so thank you, Dave, for putting this together.
And a great player.
Oh, fantastic player, man. Really good player. Hey, man, how did you feel once you got that Rick Springfield gig? Because that was like your first hurrah.
Well, I'll tell you what, and I've told people this story before. You know, I had gotten the Olivia Newton-John gig, which you mentioned earlier. And I, at the time, I was working for Andy Brower Studio Rentals. So I was doing cartage, which if people don't know what cartage is, that's essentially delivering and setting up gear for the top session players in LA. I was doing Lukather's cartage. I was doing Tim Pierce's cartage. So, you know, I'd go down to the studio, I'd set up the rig. I'd put a piece of gum on top of it for Steve, 'cause you know, he liked a piece of gum, you know, but and guitars and restring the guitars. So I quit my job at Andy's to go do the Olivia Newton-John tour. And then essentially, that tour was canceled, due to her, cancer issues. So I had to go back and beg for my job back with Andy. Fortunately, I didn't burn any bridges. I went back and Andy took it back. And then Tim Pierce, who was Rick Springfield's guitar player for all those great records that he did in the 80s, who had heard me play a bunch just through his rig on sessions, found out that Rick was going back out on the road. He was trying to revitalize his career, and he recommended me for the gig. And so, yeah, when I got that gig, Tim Pierce recommended me for the Rick gig, and it was an interesting thing because at the time I had already done a little bit of work with Patti Smyth, mm-hmm. and he was getting ready to go on the road opening for Rod Stewart.
Oh, wow. Now,
had just come out of retirement. He was in an ATV accident in, I think, 87, where he like broke a couple ribs, and he just went home and raised his kids and didn't tour. And this was 1992 or 93, I think. And so, you know, Rick wasn't even sure that anybody remembered who he was. Hmm. And so I had a little bit of a dilemma on my hands where I had the possibility of going on the road with Patti Smyth opening for Rod Stewart in arenas, or to take the gig with Rick Springfield and go to essentially a club tour.
Wow.
And I chose correctly, fortunately for me, because Patti wound up not even going on the road. She didn't even go out on the Rod Stewart thing. I think she married John McEnroe, and I think she just sort of didn't do anything. And I wound up going out on a, and it was, trust me, it was rental vans and Motel Sixes. I mean, this was pretty low budget of Rick trying to reestablish himself, but it was sold out clubs everywhere, packed, 800 people jammed into a club, and I'll never forget my very first show with him. Was at a place called Slim's, which I believe Boss Skaggs owns in San Francisco. And
is that where Rick is out of?
No, Rick's out of LA, Malibu.
Okay.
But the first gig I did was in San Francisco at a club called Slim's. And we were down in the backstage area, which was on a lower level. And I still remember very distinctly looking at Rick and going, what is this going to be like? Like, I hadn't looked at the audience. I didn't know what it was going to be like out there. And Rick looked at me and he goes, "You'll see, new guy." Rick called new guy for the entire tour. He never referred to me by my real name. As a matter of fact, when we toured Japan, he called me Shinjin, which is new guy in Japanese. But he never called me by my name. And I just remember we went up the stairs, walked out on the stage, and it was like, it was Beatlemania. I'm not kidding you. It was deafening. Wow. Screaming girls. I mean, it was nuts. I had no idea what this was going to look like. And so, yeah, man, we just, you know, it was probably only 2.5 months or 3 months that I was out with him, but it was a blast. It was totally a blast. And you know, the guitar factor on that gig, I mean, Tim Pierce having played on all those records, and it was very meaty guitar stuff for me to enjoy.
A few questions. How come, what made you pick Rick's gig over potentially doing arenas opening for Rod Stewart with Patti Smyth?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with, number one, the vibe I got off of Rick and the band, that it was, it just felt like the right move to make. Plus the, you know, Patti's thing was so nebulous because she was sort of, it seemed like she was unsure of whether she was going to go.
Okay.
I mean, believe me, the money would have been better. The venues would have been bigger, but it was sort of like bird in the hand kind of thing.
Yeah.
Rick was sort of like, are you going to do it or not? And it was right there on the table, and I took it.
How come it only lasted 2.5-3 months? What happened after that?
After that, Rick sort of took a little bit more time off, and I was sort of kicking around LA, and then and I was playing in a couple different original band projects, and then the Chicago audition happened, and once I got that gig,
yeah, okay.
Rick did go back out, but I had already gotten the Chicago gig. So, and I forget who he picked up on guitar.
Was it George Bernhard?
It was before George. And I, my college roommate, Lance Morrison, who we loaded up the Ryder truck and moved to Hollywood in the late 80s. I got him on the gig too. So Lance was playing with Rick for a good several years there, because Rick actually, once he cranked it back up, I mean, he's been out on the road pretty much ever since.
Hmm.
You know, and it's funny because the way it started, there's a club in West LA called Pelican's Retreat, and Rick, he was actually, I think he was kind of nervous about like whether anybody wanted to hear him again. So he went by his original name, Rick Springthorpe. You know, he's Australian, so his real name is Rick Springthorpe.
I didn't know that.
And Jack White, his original drummer, was the one that encouraged him to go out and start doing gigs again. So they just put on the marquee, Rick Springthorpe, on every Monday night at Pelican's Retreat, and it took, I think, 2 weeks before there was a line around the block trying to get in, once people word of mouth that it was Rick Springfield.
That's cool, man.
Kind of his way of like kind of easing back in and going like, wow, is anybody going to remember me?
Hmm.
Is it, you know, and it blew up immediately. And that was, I came in. There was a guitar player named Rocket Rashad that played with Rick before me, when he was doing the Pelican's Retreat stuff. And then also, Steve Hunter, great guitar player, was playing with him as well. So I kind of came in as the third guy.
Hmm.
in a very short span of time. I think Rocket had a gig, you know, a better gig.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Steve Hunter was doing something else as well. So, you know, and I was just this kid from Virginia that was restringing guitars for Steve Lukather and all of a sudden had the opportunity to go actually play the guitar for a living. So I was pretty excited.
That's a good story, man. You know, it's funny, George, I interviewed George a while back and he said the same thing about Rick. He said it was, he was just the nicest guy. It was like a class, you know, just a really fun, you know, positive sort of vibe there and everything.
Absolutely, man. Rick was probably one of the greatest guys I could have hooked up with to be, like my first real tour. You know, he really did, as much as he sort of, kind of ribbed me about being a new guy and being sort of green and wet behind the ears, he also sort of pulled me under his wing and kind of showed me the ropes of being on the road. So yeah, it was definitely a great opportunity for me.
I didn't talk about it because it's a really good story and I wanted you to tell it, how you got the gig with Chicago.
Okay. All right. Well, I've told this story many times and I'll try to be as concise but yet feeling as I can. So yeah, post Rick Springfield, it's late 1994. I've been playing in a couple different original band projects that were not really taken off, but cool. And at the time I was reading and listening to a lot of Tony Robbins motivational stuff. And, you know, one of the things that he preaches is essentially to take action, you know, which is, you know, don't sit in your bedroom and practice your guitar and wait for somebody to show up. Pick the phone up and call people. Do something, you know, and get outside your comfort zone. And so, you know, I picked up the phone and I called literally everybody I knew in the industry. And one of those guys was a guy named Dave Friedman. Now, Dave Friedman now is known for his incredible amplifiers, Friedman Amplification. I mean, he makes, you know, unbelievable amps. But Dave and I worked together when I was at Andy Brower. He was working for Making Music. I was working for Andy Brower. We were in the same building. And so I called Dave, who had a shop at Third Encore, which is a rehearsal studio in North Hollywood. And I just said, Dave, I said, if you ever hear of anybody having any auditions for guitar players, I'm looking for work. I'm looking for a gig. And I was looking for, I don't care if it's Janet Jackson. I don't care if it's the Moody Blues. I don't care. You know, I'm just looking for a gig.
Was it tough for you to do that?
What's that?
Was it tough for you to do, to call around and ask for help?
Yeah, it was. It's outside of my comfort zone for sure. But, you know, the little Tony Robbins on my shoulder was telling me to do it.
Yeah.
And like a day later, Dave Friedman called me back and he said, hey, Chicago is auditioning guitar players down here at Third Encore today. And I, you know, you want to talk about outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
10 o'clock in the morning. And I thought to myself, oh Jesus, you know, I can't do this. It's today and it's closed. It's a closed audition. They're listening to guys they've already picked to audition for the gig. But I dumped my Bradshaw rig and 4x12s and everything into back of my Mustang hatchback, you know, and tied it with a cable tie. And I drove down to Third Encore. And basically what happened was this. I had met Jason Scheff once. He knew the drummer, a guy named Sergio Gonzalez, who was in an original band project that I was involved in. And he stuck his head in and said hi. And ironically enough, I jokingly said to Jason at the time, you know, if you guys ever are looking for a guitar player, I'm your guy, right, for Chicago. And he laughed. Dwayne Bailey was in the band at the time. I think they were in the middle of pre-production for the big band album that they were doing. And that was the end of it. And so I sat in the parking lot that day, and I saw Robert Lamb walk by, and I saw Jimmy Pankow walk by, and I saw Walt Parizader walk by, and I was going, like, you know, I can't jump out of the car and talk to these guys. I can't. The last guy to show up was Jason. He got out of his truck. He started walking towards the rehearsal space, and I jumped out of the car, and I go, Jason, do you remember me? I was in that band with Sergio. And he kind of went, not really, man. And I'm like, man, I would really love an opportunity to audition for this gig. This is like my dream gig. I've been a huge fan of Chicago since I was a kid. I really think that, you know, I could do this gig justice. And he sort of kind of blew me off, but said, let me see what I can do. And then interestingly enough, I gave him my phone number. He called me, and he had me come to his house in Woodland Hills, and we played and we jammed together a little bit in his studio, because I think Jason wanted to see whether he was going to embarrass himself by bringing me to the audition or making these guys listen to me. And I guess whatever I did that night made him comfortable with talking them into listening to me. And I'll never forget the one thing he said to me, and this is probably not even in the most of the times I've told this story, because I kind of forgot about it. But when I was getting in my car that night, leaving Jason's house, he looked at me and he said, listen, man, he said, I'm going to tell you what I was told when I had the audition for this gig. And he said, and that is, don't freak out. This gig is yours to take. Go in there confident. Play this music. Take the gig. He said, I'm telling you right now, it's yours for the taking. If you don't freak out. So basically what he was saying was, don't be nervous and go in and be tentative. And just, he said, know that, in my opinion, you're the right guy for the gig. Just go in and take it. And so I did the best I could to not freak out, but I kind of freaked out.
It's got to be. I mean, that's.
And I was the last guy they listened to, and I played six songs, which included 25 or 6 to 4, which was the last song I auditioned on. You know, so that was like the big, big test. And, you know, a few weeks later, Jimmy Pankow was telling me that I was the only guy at the auditions that went, he said everybody else was kind of going, so he said I was the only one that like really brought the rock to it or something, which I thought was kind of funny. But that was it, man, and they offered me the gig that day. I mean, they all went, it was the most bizarre, uncomfortable thing, because after I finished playing 25 or 6 to 4, basically they called a band meeting. But he went out into the hallway and they left me in the rehearsal studio with who would become my guitar tech, Hank Steiger. And Hank was Terry Kath's guitar tech. And Hank looks at me and he goes, I think you got it, man. I think you got the gig. And I'm kind of like, don't say that, man. I was like sweating and shaking, and I had no clue. And then everybody came walking back in the room, and I think it was Robert that said, like, hey, man, you want a gig? You know? And he said, and you can have it as long as you want it. I was like, okay.
How old were you at that time?
I just turned 30.
What a great story, man.
And the funny part of, so I'm 54 years old now, right? So I had just turned 30, and all the original guys were just cracking 50.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly thinking to myself, if these guys work for maybe another like 4 or 5 years, that's going to be a great run. Well, because I thought they were going to retire at 55.
Well, because your perception of age is so different when you, yeah.
30, and I was going like, oh, I mean, well, yeah. And part of it was when I got the gig with Rick Springfield, I was 27 and Rick was 42. And I remember going, well, he looks pretty good for an old guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was only 42 years old. Mm. It's amazing how your perception can change.
Well, especially with age, because as you get older, because we're the exact same age, don't you like your bar for what you think is old? Doesn't that always go up?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, the band is working. We're working more now than we did when I first joined. Wow. There's something that I think something that changes where, you know, guys, as they get a little bit older and maybe, you know, the kids are out of the house and, you know, those responsibilities are gone. And then it becomes, hey, why don't we just, you know, work more and keep going. And, you know, I've heard the phrase used before of when people ask, like, well, when do you think you want to retire? And the question is, retire to what?
Yeah.
What am I going to retire to? I get to go out and play music in front of people that want to hear it at a level that most people don't get to do. So why would you want to not do that if it's still available to you?
Hmm.
If people stop showing up,
sure,
the work goes away, then sure, you start pondering those things. But, you know, we've been very fortunate, and I say they've been very fortunate that the music they created has created this longevity that is just off the charts, you know?
Well, and your audience is facing the same thing because your audience is getting older and the music they want to hear is not present in current music. So they want you. So it's like, you know, a perfect, you know, really, you'll have to stop when the audience starts dying. But I think you guys got a little bit of time for that, man.
Well, part of it is, too, is we're seeing a younger audience showing up.
That's great.
There, you know, there are generations. We're seeing like grandparents and parents and kids showing up at these concerts. Because, and I'm not going to sit here and say that there's not bands coming out right now that do what bands in the 70s did, but I really do still believe that, the way music was created back then, which was, you know, printed to analog tape and without the help of like say auto tune and beat detective and these things that can make things more perfect, but somehow rob you of the soul and the human element of what music is, you know? So there is a younger generation that is digging into AC/DC and the Doobie Brothers and, you know, all these great older bands, and they want to go see this, you know? And furthermore, you know, essentially in the 70s, if you went and saw a band live, you know, you were essentially hearing exactly what, I mean, it was the same guitars and the same amps and the same voices that were captured on tape to make an album. So when you went and saw them, it was, you know, nowadays, a lot of the bands have to figure out how can I recreate what I created in the studio because it was created in such a way that now I got to learn how to perform it.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas, I mean, Chicago, they basically just went in the studio and they tracked what they did, and you know, it was what it was.
I have two questions for you about that story, and thanks for sharing. It was really cool. What prompted you? you know, I know you were scared shitless, but you got out of that car. What was that little voice telling you that you got out of the car to talk with Jason?
Well, I mean, I had already basically crammed about, you know, 800 pounds of gear into the back of my car, driven about 40 miles to go down there. So, you know, I had that kind of kicking me in the ass a little bit to go ahead and try to, you know, take a shot at this thing. And, you know, it really is one of those moments where, you know, and I have no idea, no clue what I would be doing right now had I not done what I did. Would I still be in the music industry? Would I still be, you know, would I have done something different? I don't know. Could I have wound up playing with the Eagles? Or, I mean, who knows what would have happened? But, you know, that was a defining moment. And even prior to the one of getting out of the car, just, I mean, I was literally one split second away from hanging the phone up, from Dave Friedman calling me and telling me about the Chicago audition and like just making more coffee and turning on and saying, you know, I'll get the next one. You know, this is happening now. I can't, you know.
And you knew what you happen to know all these tunes, which is pretty unusual because it's not like great songs, but they're not standard cover tunes.
No, and actually, ironically enough, Hank Steger, who I mentioned earlier, who was the guitar tech, he told me what the six songs that they were auditioning on, and I actually, because the auditions weren't starting until later in the day, I ran over to, I don't know if it was Blockbuster or somewhere, and I bought a Greatest Hits album and sat in my car with the guitar, you know, with the tunes. And, you know, they were firmly implanted into my brain, but I had to get them under my hands.
That's a lot. I mean, it was serendipity sort of, man. Everything that was supposed to, that could have happened in your favor happened. You know, it's weird. Like, I always look at these things and like, it's sometimes, I'm not getting religious at all, but there's something going on, higher power, call it with the universe, whatever you want, that's kind of making these moves for you. Because, you know, it's like everything opens up, man. It's like, that's not, I mean, you can't even do that shit on your own almost, you know?
Well, I mean, it's funny you say that, because just like days after I got that gig, I remember vividly, I was living out in the Santa Clarita Valley, which is sort of, it's north of Los Angeles. And at the time there weren't a lot of people out there. And I remember waking up at like 6 a.m., which is not my thing at all. I mean, I just woke straight up and I walked out of my house. I walked up the street and I just sat down on the edge of this kind of bluff overlooking the whole valley, and like birds were taking off and it was just completely serene and quiet. And I remember just kind of feeling like, wow, you know, something really unusual has just happened here. Because like you say, the everything that sort of fell together at once, I mean, it almost intellectually didn't make sense to me.
Right. Right.
It's like you said, it was like, it all just sort of, the pieces came together and, you know, and my influences on the guitar, you know, one of the things that they later told me that sort of worked out into my favor was, you know, Chicago had two eras. Okay. There was the 70s, the Terry Kath, Guercio production era. And then there was the David Foster 80s era.
Yeah.
So there's Terry Kath, and then you have Steve Lukather, Michael Landau, Paul Jackson Jr., right? Who were the guitar players on the Foster stuff. And who were my biggest influences? Well, Terry Kath, Steve Lukather, Michael Landau. So you know, I had the Bradshaw rig, I had the 80s sounds, I had all the that thing, but I also was steeped in the retro R&B stuff that was the Terry Kath era of the band.
Yeah.
So when I auditioned, and according to Jason, when we did Hard Habit to Break, all of a sudden I sounded like Steve Lukather, right? And when we did 25 or 6 to 4, I sounded like Terry Kath. He said, where all the other guys sounded like one guy playing the same songs. So somehow or another, the fact that, you know, my age and my influences sort of put all that together, you know, made it work for me.
Yeah. And the other thing that was amazing was how Jason, tell everybody who Jason is, because they may not know. Listeners may not know.
Well, I mean, Jason's the tenor lead vocalist for Chicago for 30 years, right. Replaced Peter Cetera. You want to talk about pressure? You think I was freaking out? Jason was 23 years old, and he took over the lead vocal bass slot for freaking Cetera.
Yeah, that's heavy.
When they were at the absolute peak of their success. So, I mean, I got to, you know, tip of the hat to Jason, because that's just, I mean, that's insane.
But that whole thing, though, even that, you know, he said, when you called him out and he said, hey, you know, we did this, do you remember? And he goes, nah, not really. But like, so again, what's the likelihood of he like doesn't even know who you are? And he goes, hey, come over to my house and I'll help you. Like, you know, I'm just, it's all I can say is I think when stuff happens like that, man, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing, because you couldn't have planned that out. The odds so freaking small on each little micro movement there.
Well, you know what? I think Jason, you know, and he kind of admitted to me later that, you know, on a selfish level, he was sort of making sure that, like I said, he wasn't going to be embarrassed.
Hmm.
That,
you know, oh yeah.
He was going to ask the guys to add an extra day, pay for another day to hear another guitar player. And, but on the other hand, he also told me that, you know, that he wanted to make sure that they were getting the right guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had, I mean, I saw the resume of all the guys that were auditioning for the gig, and all of them blew me just completely out of the water. I basically had Rick Springfield, and that was about it.
Oh, and you mean experience-wise, and you know, yeah.
Guys all had pedigrees that were a mile long. And, you know, hey, probably part of their rationale or influence was, hey, we got a young guy here who maybe would be willing to go out on the road for, you know, a couple of pizzas and a beer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to some of the guys that were auditioning that had huge pedigrees that were going to, you know, hold them up for tons of dough or something like that.
Sure.
Or, you know, I don't think, I'm kind of being funny here. I'm just kind of kidding on that level.
I think they
chose because I seemed like the right guy. But they certainly did see my enthusiasm for wanting to do the gig. The fact that I was really, really excited about the prospect. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Because, and like I say, there was, and I wasn't there for the different auditions, but it was like, I said, like, you know, they had one guy came in and he could solo circles around anybody. He was the greatest, you know, guitar soloist, but he didn't really sing well.
Mm.
Then they had a guy who he sang his ass off and he played rhythm guitar like nobody's business, but he couldn't solo great, you know? And so I guess I came in and kind of jack of all trades, master of none.
Hey, whatever, call it whatever you want, man. You know, whatever. Great. It worked, you know.
Right.
What a cool story, man. Thank you. You're originally from Maryland. I know you moved to Virginia. What was your childhood like growing up?
My childhood growing up was great. I was, grew up in a upper middle class family. My parents were, every Christmas was, whatever new amp I wanted or guitar I wanted. And, now looking back on it, I suppose I would say that I was spoiled.
Yeah.
Well,
at least you're smart. You're probably smart enough not to repeat that.
Yeah. And when I was in junior high school, we had it's like a stage band, which was basically, a rhythm section and a horn band. And that was kind of the beginning of it for me. And I was playing guitar and the band director, Mrs. Monroe, would allow the rhythm section at the end of our stage band concerts to play pop songs. So we were doing Long Time by Boston and Free Bird. And so, that was my first taste of getting up in front of people and playing the guitar and feeling that, whatever you want to call it, connection or
energy
being pumped.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the beginning of me going like, wow, I think I want to do this. I was in a country band playing bass guitar when I was 14 with guys that were in their late 30s. We're doing, yeah, that was,
that's your thing, man. You always get in bands with older guys.
Apparently.
Yeah, that's your thing.
Although now I'm not the youngest guy anymore.
Who is?
I'm finally seeing a changing of the guard. We got Brett Simons on bass, who's about 4 years younger than me. Ray Eastlass on percussion, who is about 4 years younger than me. I always was the young guy. I guess not anymore.
No, man. Shit changes.
It happens to all of us, doesn't it?
It changes, man. I was the same. So you had a good upbringing. Any brothers or sisters you had? I think you had a brother, you said, right?
Yeah, older brother, drummer. Great drummer. And he is another one that I would credit to almost single-handedly shaping my musical path, because, I was all about rock. I loved Kiss, Ted Nugent. I'm trying to think. And so what my brother would do every Christmas, he would go out and buy me albums that he thought I might like, but that I wouldn't seek out for myself.
Wow, what a cool brother.
Oh, yeah.
Very
so,
cool.
So, like, it was Toto's first album. The first couple of records from Journey when Steve Perry was in the band. Earth, Wind, and Fire. Oh my God, Jeff Beck, Blow by Blow. I didn't even know who Jeff Beck was. And
great
he bought
record.
That for me, and it pretty much just set me on my ear. Like I said, I was all about just straight up rock stuff. And Toto, Journey, Steely Dan. So he pretty much single-handedly expanded my harmonic sense in a way that, pretty much enabled me to, because Chicago's music is harmonically complex.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known what a D7 sharp 9 was had my brother not turned me on to some of these records. And
sure.
I started trying to find, I was just playing just straight up power chords. I didn't know any of that stuff. So he opened my ears because he was much, much more into jazz and fusion. You know, he was listening to Weather Report and the Crusaders, and you know, so all this music was playing in the household. But I got to give him credit for, you know, I would have been, I would have just been a straight up rock guy.
That's awesome, man. Good you have him. That's part of the whole thing, man. The whole circle of all this shit that had to happen. It's kind of funny, man.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. As far as tuition goes, you know, we all kind of like pay tuition and make mistakes in our career, no matter what you're doing. Can you share maybe one or two mistakes you made along the way, and what were the lessons that you learned from them?
Mistakes. Man, I've been pretty blessed that I will tell you this. The only gig that I auditioned for that I didn't get, and I'm not telling this to be in any way arrogant or, you know, I auditioned for Olivia Newton-John, I got the gig. I auditioned for Patti Smythe, I got the gig. I auditioned for Chicago, I got the gig. I auditioned for Rick, I got the gig. I auditioned for Tom Jones.
Oh, okay.
And the way the audition went down was basically you showed up with your guitar and an amp, and they put a chart in front of you to read a chart, and they had a video camera on you. And basically, you just basically had to play the chart down with no band around you, no musicians there. So they just wanted to see if you could read.
Right.
And one of the things that I did in my musical upbringing was I avoided at every cost learning how to read music. I mean, a chord chart, yeah, but actually being able to read rhythmic notation and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I just crashed and burned trying to play. You know, it's not unusual, and I tried the best I could with by my ear, but I didn't get the gig.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, and I still don't regret it really, but probably not being able to read music was a mistake. I probably could have got that gig. But as far as, you know, anything further than that, music career wise, you know, I feel like it's like you say, higher power, God, whatever it is. I feel like I was on a path that just sort of kind of led me through.
It's awesome.
Maybe I'm supposed to get the Tom Jones gig.
That's great. I mean, that's wonderful.
Maybe I would have been out with Tom Jones when Chicago was finding their new guitar player.
Yeah.
Don't know.
He has like I've talked to a number of guys who've played with him over the years. In fact, I think the bass player from Shem, do you know Shem?
Shem Von Trek.
Yep. Yeah. I think he played with Tom. And I think the deal is that he doesn't have a permanent band. He's got like US guys when he comes here, and he's got UK guys when he goes there. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I've heard Tom Jones is a wonderful guy, and he's great to work with. He still sings his ass off.
I know.
I mean, it's ridiculous. But but hey, you know.
You're here, man.
We're all where we are for a reason.
Is there anything, if you could go back and give advice to your younger self, like what advice do you think you might have benefited from, either personally or career-wise? And the second part of that is, are you still of the mindset, and do you still try to get out of your comfort zone and do things?
Well, that's a tough one. Yeah, the advice I would give to my younger self is don't move to LA and don't try to make it in the music business because it's too difficult.
Well, you wouldn't want to hear that. You wouldn't have listened to that.
Even though it worked out in the end, what was I going to say? Oh, what was the second part of the question again?
Are you still, like, do you still actively try to do things to get out of your comfort zone?
You know what? A little bit, man. What I'm trying to do now is to get back to a place of really, like on this button project that I was telling you about with John Cowan and Ed Toth. Most of the stuff on that record, guitar solos and things, were live tracked, you know, stream of consciousness kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm as guilty as the next guy of getting into ruts of, you know, find what works and stick with it and don't break out of that mold. So I'm trying to sort of push myself into taking more chances in my solos, and you know, if I'm used to starting on the 12th fret on the B string at the beginning of a solo, I'll go down to the nut and start down there and go, you know, and see if it takes me into a different direction. Because, you know, I've seen enough YouTubes of me playing where it's 1997 and I'm playing the same solo that I played in 2007, you know. So that's kind of, because, you know, when you have a gig and it's a good gig and you, like you say, you find things that work and people like it, it's easy to just stay there.
Yeah, wash, rinse, repeat. Yeah, I totally get that, man. Yeah,
totally. So I'm just trying to kick myself into, you know, forcing myself to do some different stuff.
It's good for you, man.
Yeah, and I might even actually try to practice a little bit.
No.
It's funny. I'm sitting in my studio looking around, and it's like, I don't know how long we've been off. I have not touched a guitar. Well, except for to do the drum clinic with Wally.
Yeah, but you're playing guitar like all the time. It's not like you've been off for 3 months, man.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a normal break. I mean, it's like if you're an athlete and you get a break after competition season, you're probably the first few weeks not going to be training at 6 a.m. like you do every day. I wouldn't think. A professional athlete or a professional guitar player, but just doing shit like that.
That's true.
Yeah.
And so, to be honest with you, that's probably been one of my, I don't even know if the word would be downfall, but a lot of this has come relatively easily to me in terms of having natural ability on the instrument and having good ears, and to where I haven't had to work really, really hard to excel. But the yin and the yang to that is that because of that, maybe I don't play at the level that I probably could.
Mm.
If you know what I'm saying, if I had the,
I do.
And certainly I spent a lot of years when I was younger, you know, with the guitar in my hands, practicing and, you know, putting records on and trying to learn what guys were doing and stuff like that. But, you know, there's, you know, Lee Lochnane, the trumpet player in our band, he still practices his trumpet like 3 hours a day, every day. Yeah. He's in his early 70s.
Wow.
That's a commitment, man. And I'm kind of envious of his dedication and that he does what he does, because he actually is. He's getting better. He's getting better every year.
Do you know?
That's pretty amazing.
You know, whatever you're putting in, man, it usually comes back out.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, man. So let's talk about gear for a few minutes. and I know we talked about guitars early, and I know you got a shit ton of them. What is like your go-to guitar, and what other guitars maybe would round out your top three? But I don't mean guitars that you have to play for a certain piece. I mean guitars you like picking up. What's the first one you like to play?
Man, you know what? And this has been the way I've dealt with guitars my whole life. You know, they're kind of like women. You know, mm-hmm. you get them, you put your hands on them, you live with them for a little bit, and if they work for you, then you keep them. And they don't, for whatever reason, if they don't, you get rid of them.
All right. I don't know how that'll get over with 23% of my listeners that are women, but you know, fair enough.
Well, I'm just saying that you know, you can go and order a guitar from a great boutique builder and say, I want this neck and I want this body and I want this and this. And then you get it and it just doesn't quite do it for you. You know, every guitar is its own individual, in my opinion. So pretty much everything that I own right now, there's something special about it. And whether that's, my Tom Andersons, Jim Tyler's custom shop Fender stuff. I even have a couple of, kind of off the rack, what do they call them? American Professional Fenders that, which shockingly to me, I never thought I would play a Tele Deluxe with two humbuckers. But these American Pro Tele Deluxes are like really, really amazing. Tim Shaw did a great job on the pickups on them. You know, and I even have a guitar over here that's sitting in my rack that is a mid-80s Fender 60 something reissue Japanese that Mike Tuttle redid the neck on, and I put Lindy Fralin pickups in, and it's one of the cooler guitars I have. But you know, it was considered kind of a shit, you know, not American reissue. Oh, and I forgot the most important part of it. The guitar sounded like ass. And even after I put the Fralins in it, and I took it out into my garage and I took a finishing sander to it, and I basically took all the lacquer off of it. I basically relic'd it myself, and it immediately became one of the best sounding guitars I have.
That's weird.
Well, I mean, that's what a lot of people don't realize is that the you know, the tone wood, the more lacquer you put on it, the more it chokes it out. So, you know, if you take the lacquer off, that's what makes all those great vintage Fenders with the nitrocellulose, because the nitrocellulose breaks down over time and it erodes, and it basically almost, it's a very, very thin type of lacquer. In the late 70s and the 80s, they started to figure out how to make it prettier and make it last longer, but it chokes the tone of the guitar out. And, you know, Tim Pierce, I remember, he had two Tom Andersons built for him that had no lacquer on them. They were just a swamp ash body with nothing, no color, no paint, no nothing. And they were the best sounding guitars he had, just for the very reason, you know, because it's, you know, aesthetics are nice and everything, but tone is another thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's another reason why, and I've come to the conclusion that this is true too. Black guitars tend to sound better than most other guitars because it takes a very, very light coat of black paint to cover. You know, if you're doing a sunburst or a a metallic look or something like that, they have to put so much paint on to get it to cover that it chokes the tone of the guitar out.
So which of those is your number one? Like if one you'd love to grab?
Probably my number one would be what my guitar tech calls OG, which means original green. And that's it's an 89 Tom Anderson classic with a green finish.
That's the one you were playing that night, probably, I think. Probably. When you were down here.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. That guitar, there's something special about it. You know, it's one of those things where it just works and sounds amazing. And I got to say that new Les Paul.
Amato's?
Thank you, Dave
Amato. Yeah, there you go.
You know, the funny part of it is that you know, my first real guitar, real good guitar was a Les Paul. It was a 74 Deluxe with the smaller like soap bar pickups in a burst. And I had it redone with the DiMarzios, which at the time with Al Di Meola and all those, that was what people were dropping in there. But interestingly enough, going back to the Gibson scale, which is shorter than a Fender scale, it's almost like going home. You know, my hands just feel comfortable on it. So it's sort of reconnected me with my childhood and youth.
Very good.
Thank you, Dave Amato.
There you go. I tell you what I love about those Andersons, man. I had one time, the frets, they're like steel or something like that, or I don't know what they use, but man, they are the easiest necks to get around. Good Lord, man.
Oh yeah. And a lot of people don't realize this about Tom. Tom is a really, really good guitar player. You know, some guitar manufacturers are not great players, but Tom, he's one of the few manufacturers that I feel like I can call him up and I can say, I want this and I want this and I want these specs. And I know that the guitar is going to be great when it gets in my hands, because he doesn't let anything come out of his shop that he doesn't put his hands on. Mm. If he doesn't think it's great, it doesn't leave.
No.
So, you know,
I did love that. I've got to get another one of those. I love that neck I had. It was great.
Yeah, he's moved on to stainless steel frets. You're right.
Yeah, I think it made a world of, I mean, it was like cheating. You know, it was really incredible. Who's influenced you that people might be surprised?
Who's influenced me that people might be surprised? Well, there's the obvious guys, the Eddie Van Halen, Jeff Beck, Steve Lukather, Michael Landau, Larry Carlton, obviously Terry Kath. But probably one of my earliest biggest influences was Ted Nugent.
Yeah. You had mentioned that.
And Carlos Santana.
Great. Two great players, man.
When I was a kid, my brother and I used to go into, well, what was a converted garage into like a music room, and we would turn the lights off and we would put Santana Moonflower, the live album, on, and the two of us would just play to it. And it got to the point where I could play that whole record note for note, Europa and all that stuff. And, so, yeah, I mean, even though I don't really listen to too much of Ted or Carlos these days, they were a big part of my early development.
That's awesome.
And later on, I started listening, you know, obviously, I started listening to some of the guys that I can't even come close to replicating, but, you know, Scott Henderson and Mike Stern and Alan Holdsworth. And, you know, I did start listening to jazz. I remember when I was living in L.A., do you know who Neil Steubenhaus is?
No. Baseball. No, yeah. Who's he played with?
Neil's huge session player, played with literally – I think he played with Miles Davis at one point. But anyway, Neil's a great bass player, and I rented a guest house from him early on when I was living in L.A. It was like 500-square-foot little separate guest house, and I remember he came over to collect the rent one day, and I was listening to a John Scofield record, and I said something to Neil like, yeah, I can't play like that. I'll never be able to play like that. He said, the fact that you're listening to it says a lot. And I thought, yeah, that actually kind of makes sense. You know, you mean expanding your ears.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not you really dig into it, and it's still going to shape what you do.
Yeah, for sure. What's going to come out of your instrument.
Exactly.
Desert Island Discs. Tough question. No particular order. Top three, just for now, man. It could change 10 minutes from now. It's your knee-jerk reaction.
Top three? Wow. I'm going to say Steely Dan Asia, Van Halen Fair Warning. Ooh, wow. Man, I'm gonna have to go corporate here and say Chicago Transit Authority.
There you go. You've done your duty. Which is a great album.
Oh yeah.
Tough question here, man. What do you like most about yourself?
Who do I like most about myself? Oh, yikes. Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't know. I like to think that I have a somewhat sunny disposition on life, and I tend to try to be a positive energy if I can. So maybe that's sort of, and you know, that it may be tempered a little bit with an internal darkness, but my goal outwardly, especially when I'm in, you know, whether I'm on a tour bus or in a group of people, is to try to be funny, try to be engaging, try to. Yeah, I don't know. I guess there's not much I like about myself.
That's not an uncommon answer for, like, I interviewed, do you know Adam Zimmern? He's out in California. No, you're in, sorry, I thought you were in California for a second.
Andy Timmons?
Adam Zimmern?
No, I don't.
He plays with Ziggy Marley. And I asked him that question one time, and he had like the quintessential artist response. He said, how can I answer that question when I am so filled with self-loathing?
Yeah.
And I've had so many other guys like basically say different words, but say the same thing. It's a tough question for a lot of people, man.
The alternative question would be, what don't you like about yourself? And that probably could be filled with any number of answers.
Well, that was, I was going to say, how about if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
I would say if I could change one thing about myself, it would be to have a little bit more drive and motivation to, you know, really go after trying to improve my craft. You know, what we discussed before, being sort of blessed/cursed with a lot of natural ability, which has somewhat robbed me of feeling the need to really sort of hone my craft.
Sure, I get it. I thought you were going to say change one thing is not be so sunny, not have such a sunny disposition.
More of
an asshole. Something or someone you miss from your childhood.
Something
or someone you miss from your childhood.
From my childhood. Wow. Oh man. No, I'm pretty much still in touch with a lot of the folks that I hung out with as a kid.
That's awesome.
Although I will say this about myself, and my wife can attest to this, and you know, there is something to be said for, you know, I have friends that I may not speak to for 8 months, a year, but then if I get on the phone with them, we may talk for 6 hours, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things of those are the kind of friendships, like this really, really good buddy of mine that was a college roommate of mine. He's an incredible drummer. Name's Chris Salamone. He's mixing front of house for Hall & Oates now. And, you know, he and I used to be just like when we were in college together, we would stay up all night tweaking with gear. And we were really into the sound systems and PAs and, you know, just dicking around with all that kind of stuff. And he's sort of, I mean, I still consider myself an engineer, but he, you know, obviously he's mixing front of house for Hall & Oates. He stayed with it. And, he's one of those guys that like, I may not talk to him for 2 years and then we'll get on the phone and it's like hours go by, you know? So, I don't know if that means being a bad friend or if that's
being a busy adult.
Maybe.
It's hard to you know.
That's true. You might be right about that. Maybe there is a certain level of maturity involved when people don't get their panties in a bunch because you haven't talked to them in a year.
Yeah. I have buddies like that. Not usually doesn't go a year, but it'll go several months and we'll get on the phone and hang.
So what are you trying to say?
Nothing. I'm just saying I understand, Keith. You better go easy on me. I'm going to ask you tougher questions, man.
Uh-oh.
When you're having a bad day, man, what do you do to make yourself feel better?
Eat something, drink something.
What is that called? I was talking to someone, they said they go shopping, but it's like a similar thing.
Well, those are usually the three top. Buy things, eat things, drink things.
Yeah, shopping therapy, that's what they call it. Yeah.
Or maybe take a...
What's that?
I said, or maybe take a nap.
There you go, man. Happiest moment or time in your life?
Whoosh, a lot of them. I've been very fortunate in that respect. Obviously, right after getting the gig with Chicago, and, you know, I was 30 years old and living in Southern California, and, you know, it all felt like it was coming together. So, yeah, that was probably one of them. You know, the summer with Rick was great. Birth of my children. Yeah, it's all been pretty good. There've been some dark times, but you know, we all have to deal with that.
Oh, hell yeah. Most important thing your dad taught you.
Probably the most important thing my dad taught me, and I probably didn't heed it well enough, was that if you're going to do something, do it as well as you can. I remember when I was a kid, he had me washing his Pinto.
His Ford Pinto.
Oh, yeah. Blue Ford Pinto. That's what I learned to drive on. And I kind of did a half-assed job of washing the car. And he came out and he said, son, if you're going to do something, do it right. Do it to the best of your ability. And he kind of pointed to the dirty spots on the car. And that kind of resonated, though, with the way I approached music and those kind of things. You know, my father's, he's not musical at all. But I tell you, he's like one of the most, he still scours social media and YouTube and trying to find things to watch of me playing. And
that's cool, man.
My biggest supporter.
That's awesome. They're really cool. Yeah. How about your mom? What's the most important thing she taught you?
Wow. She just was my father was the provider of the family, but she was the rock. She honestly, probably even more so than my father, was the one who always supported me trying to do what I wanted to do and not trying to encourage me to do what she thought I should do. So in other words, whatever I wanted to be and what I wanted to pursue, she was the one that was like, well, I'm there to support you in that then. Because my older brother, he's a drummer, but he went to college, got his master's degree, he went to work for IBM, he did exactly what my father did. One that was like, I think I want to move to LA with my, a couch and a couple of Marshalls and a couple of guitars and see what I can do with that. And they were like, great. How can we support you in that?
That's awesome. Very cool, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's the, a lot of times people ask me, what are the common traits that successful guitar players have? And I'd say 95% of them had very supportive families towards their music. Yeah. It's like 95. Yep. Yeah.
Well, and the funny part of it was that was how, my brother was playing the drums and I was 6 years old or something. And, my parents bought me a guitar and got me guitar lessons and sort of encouraged me to stick with it, even though, I came home from my first guitar lesson and cried because it hurt my fingers.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't do what they asked me to do. And even in the less than ideal times, they were encouraging. And, as far as musicality goes with my parents, with the exception of the fact that my mother sang in the church choir and played a little bit of piano, that was about it.
You know, but it's great that they supported you, man. That's really cool.
Absolutely.
Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
None that I can tell you about. I don't golf. I don't, music is my career. It's my hobby. It's the only other thing I think I'm a little bit passionate about is the Kansas City Chiefs.
There you go.
That's my
who are they playing this week?
Chiefs. I love watching football. And ironically enough, I didn't even start paying attention to football till I was in my late 20s. I hated everything that had to do with a ball growing up.
Why Kansas City? You're from, is that was like reasonably close? It wasn't close to where you are from, is it?
No, I was living in LA. And my roommate was a guy named Joe Ness, who actually worked for Tom Anderson Guitar Works. And he was from the Bay Area. And so he was a 49ers fan. And it seemed like at that time, whenever that was, in the 80s, I think, that that the 49ers were on Monday Night Football like every week.
Yeah, that was the Joe Montana and the what's his name era.
Yep, Joe Montana. And so, you know, we'd go out to bars on Monday Night Football and have a few beers, and there'd be pretty girls around, and I'm looking at the TV and I'm seeing Joe Montana and I'm going, you know, I kind of think I like this guy. And then suddenly I became a football fan, and then they traded him to Kansas City.
Okay.
I followed him there, and then I stuck. That became my team.
You see that game last week that New England won? That was – what a game, though, man. I mean
– oh, great game, but boy, what the
– incredible.
When the defensive end let go of Tom Brady and he ran into the end zone, that was – he had him wrapped up because of the new rules. It's like, oh, I can't take him to the ground. I better let go. So he runs in for the touchdown.
Really good. That game – helped me win my fantasy game last week. Yeah, because I had what's his name?
Mahomes.
No, I had Gronkowski. So you know, so that was, and he went out, but I got enough yards there, so we were able to win it.
Who's your team?
Oakland Raiders, believe it or not. I've like picked loser the Raiders and the Knicks. I mean, just like go figure. They're like a lifetime of punishment. Lifetime of punishment.
Wow.
I know. Yeah,
it's not looking good this year.
No. And, you know, I think it's like even more of a disappointment because of, you know, Jeff. Yeah, because he's back. So, yeah. Gruden. Wow. Hey, man, what's a favorite place you've traveled? You've been all over the world at this point.
You know, my kids asked me that the other day, and I, the answer I came up with was Singapore. It looks like something like not real. It's so unbelievably clean, and there's reasons for that, but the architecture is just so wild and different. You know, they got that like crazy looking thing. It's like a cruise ship on top of like three high rise.
I saw that in a thing on Netflix. Yeah. That was, yeah I saw that.
We were in a hotel in my balcony. I could see that thing and I was like taking pictures of it going, I mean, literally it looks like a cruise ship sitting up like 80 stories above the ground on top of three high rises.
It's really just trippy.
You know, cause, and I guess, part of a deal there is that it's, the rules or the laws are so strict. That's why it's so safe and clean. I mean, if you spit gum on the sidewalk, you're like, you know,
you're arrested for that, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but apparently in Singapore, you can walk anywhere at any time and you're completely safe.
Man, I had some clients there, it's 25 years ago, and I remember they were young kids, and they were just so industrious, and they said most people over, it's very supportive to young people who run businesses. You live with your elders and like several generations. It's just a different culture there, but that's what they said. It's really clean. I've heard that. A couple of tough questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Talk about a specific experience that changed your life or altered the way you think about things?
Oh, man. That's a tough one. An experience that changed the way I think about things?
Changed your life or changed the way you think about things? Doesn't have to be a bad experience. It could be a real good experience.
You know, having kids, that completely changes your perspective on everything because suddenly, you know, you go from thinking about yourself and what you want for you and worrying about them and what you want for them.
Hmm.
So it definitely, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I completely got pulled out of narcissism, but you know, having kids definitely drags you a little bit out of a out of a selfish place and into a more open-minded field.
Yeah, totally. So
probably. That would be it for me.
Most embarrassing or funniest thing that's ever happened to you on stage or in the studio?
Most embarrassing thing or funniest thing? We were playing Universal Amphitheater, God, years ago, probably 20 years ago. And a girl in the audience, with her mother's prodding, basically climbed on the stage and dipped me and kissed me and then fell to the ground. That was probably one. And the other would be, we were playing a show in Dallas and apparently a local strip club thought it would be a good idea to bring some of their clients into the venue, and have them expose themselves whilst handing out cards to their establishment.
Oh. So
there were like five or six young ladies in front of me that basically flashed me from the audience. And I turned beet red and then the owner, I guess, was handing out business cards to, you know, for people to go after the show.
That's funny, man. You know, it was interesting when you were down here, we saw Dave and then you guys played. Dave got, we were backstage, my wife and I, and she couldn't believe how many women our age were like, just, you know, waving at Dave and just like, it was like they were 17 again. And it was really, you know, she was like, Craig, those women are our age, you know,
right.
You know, it's fun. It's a funny dynamic that people, this is what they, you know, they, it's like a recreation of childhood almost.
I was going to say rock and roll can do some crazy things.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just funny. And last question, Keith, what do you do, if anything, to make sure that you're getting the most out of life and enjoying your time as much as possible?
Oh man, probably just, I always just try to live in the moment. You know, I just try to be present wherever I am. I try not to think too much about what went on behind me or what's coming up ahead of me. And that may even be problematic at times, but it's just the way I kind of am wired.
That's great. Were you always like that? Or
kind of.
That's great, man. Yeah. Very cool.
You like when you opened up and kind of read that bio a little bit, it was sort of like half of that stuff I didn't even remember.
Yeah.
But sort of triggered it in my brain and you know. So it's it, yeah. I just think that's I've always been that way. I almost accredit it to having a bad memory, which I think I inherited from my father. But
but that's good in a way. That's
it. You're in the now.
You know, years ago they interviewed, I was watching an interview with Troy Aikman from the Cowboys, and he said, what's the most important trait a quarterback needs? And he said, a short memory.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that's a blessing and a curse, maybe.
Yep. Well, and the good news and the bad news of it is that I can't really wallow too much in the bad things that have happened in my life.
Which is great.
Conjure them up. But I also don't revel in the good things that have happened to me, you know, by being able to bring them into my consciousness, because it's all kind of just gray matter gone
yesterday.
I'm on to the next thing.
Hey man, I can't thank you enough for your time. Let's talk about your new project. Keith's got a project out. It's called Button. It's as he said, let me, I wrote down pop music with long ass solos. Do you want to talk about some of that?
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? It's, we were on the road with the Doobie Brothers and Ed Toth, the drummer for the Doobs, and John Cowan. We all realized that we lived in Nashville. So we decided to put a band together. And it started out as a group called Secret Agent Orange, where we did cover tunes of, you know, Cream and Hendrix. And it's on YouTube. If you search Secret Agent Orange, you'll probably find some of it. But what it morphed into was a sort of a power trio of me, John, and Ed writing original material. And we changed the name to Button. The origin of the band name is from my oldest daughter. When she was a child, she referred to her derriere as her button.
That's so cute.
And if she passed gas, she called it button magic.
Yeah.
So we took,
sounds we smart.
We took the name Button and made the band name that. And basically, it's a really organic kind of jam bandy sort of thing that encompasses all of our influences. You'll hear everything from, you know, a hint of bluegrass to R&B to there's even one track on there that sounds kind of like mid-80s Van Halen to, you know, and Cowan is just a freak tenor vocalist. So, yeah, so if you dig around on iTunes or I think Amazon or CD Baby, you'll find the record. You'll know it's the right record if it has a guy in a suit walking a cat down a street. That's the cover. There is some electronica band called Button out of Europe.
Okay.
We haven't been sued by them yet, so we'll see.
Well, you can call the magic button if you do. That sounds, or button magic. It sounds great. You know, swapped
better than just button.
I kind of do too, actually. Yeah, button magic is cool.
But
man, you know what? I have one last question to ask you. When you're doing the opening of 25 or 6 to 4, is it like a full whole bar chord, or is it just the top strings, or is it just, you know, the like Ritchie Blackmore used to do? Is it just the fourth and fifth string? What are you playing?
And this is a hot button topic, Danny. I'm glad you asked this, because when I auditioned for the gig, there were guys that played, that put the fifth into the, right? That ain't it. It's an octave. It's, and on the record, it was doubled with bass.
Okay.
But it's just the octave. There is no fifth in there. You know what I mean?
So it's just the sixth string and the fourth string?
Sixth string and the fourth string until you get down to the E chord at the end, and that you actually can play the fifth. Right?
Okay. So what are you doing? You're muting the fifth string?
Yeah.
Okay.
Muting the fifth string. And essentially it's an A minor voicing on top, with that descending bass note.
It sounds so cool, man.
And actually, a lot of people don't realize that guitar part is on the record.
That's so cool.
Right? Yeah, but yeah.
Man, you could spend like probably a whole lifetime just giving seminars on.
It makes me really, really agitated though when I hear people playing, putting the fifth in that guitar riff, because it's just not right.
Yeah. I had a funny feeling it wasn't conventional. That's what I wanted to ask. I was just, it got me thinking about it was when you talked about why you got the gig that you opened up with, you know, it wasn't like some kind of pussy or, you know, wimpy little sound. And then that stuck in my brain. And then like, I knew I had to ask you a question about that for my personal interest. And then like, it just came out in the nick of time, man. So thank you. And next time we talk color my world where there's no guitar.
Whole other.
Dude, thank you very much for everything, Keith. I really appreciate it. Everybody check out Button. It's Keith's project with Ed Toth and John Cowan. Go see Chicago. Obviously, they're a freaking awesome band. Keith's on Facebook at Keith Howland Fans, and he makes a guest appearance there once in a while. And that's it, man. Thank you so much. Any final words of wisdom?
I don't know. Don't take any wooden nickels. I don't.
There you go. Thanks, man. I appreciate your time, Keith. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it with a friend on social media. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Keith Howland for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And check out his side project called Button. Make sure you get a homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.